can't.
Well, the history of remakes is ripe of great reimagining of films. Like, think of True Grit, remade by the Coen brothers. Think of Hitchcock remaking himself, I think, on The Man Who Knew Too Much. Or think of John Carpenter's The Thing. There is not one approach to a text that is used as a source to do something new. I think it's not just given for granted that any remake is a bad thing. I think cinema is about point of view. It's about what you can tell from your perspective. I believe that there is no new story that can be told. So it's more about the point of view.
Welcome to Speak All Evil, the podcast you were warned about. I'm Trent, here with Kevin and Kat. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
We are down a hand this week, and we are semi-remote. It's been a while since we've done this. I'm feeling a little bit discombobulated here.
Yeah, I like it.
Guys, seen anything good this week besides what we're going to talk about?
I watched Resident Alien a lot with Alan Tudyk. We love that guy, right?
No clue.
So it's like a sci-fi show. Alan Tudyk from Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's fun. It's like a fun sci-fi show where he's an alien on planet Earth and he murdered the guy that he took the body over of. And yeah, it's fun.
I watched a whole bunch of things that I won't bother to talk about because they were all bad. I don't know how this happened to me. I just started falling on rando Tubi and deep prime cuts of found footage movies. It was all trash.
I just saw a movie that I've been curious about for a long time called Don't Look Now from 1973. You heard about that, Kevin?
Yeah.
Donald Sutherland, a very young Donald Sutherland, and Julie Christie, I believe, is the lead actress. It's really good. They play a couple who lost a young daughter in a drowning accident. They're American, I believe. They end up in Venice and he restores old churches and they're grieving the loss of their daughter and they meet a couple old ladies, at least one of which is a psychic or claims to be psychic and claims to be able to contact their dead daughter. It's really, really good. I definitely will watch it again. We might be talking about it on my next week. It reminded me a little bit of Possession. It reminded me of something else. It's escaping me at the moment, but it's very kind of like family grief, questioning reality, questioning what you see. There's a lot of stuff about precognition, like premonitionary visions and things like that. It's pretty wild. There's a lot there, but I would highly recommend it. It's on Paramount Plus right now. If you haven't seen Don't Look Now, very good. Might come up again soon. This week, it's Kevin's prep school week, or it's Kevin's girl school week, or Kevin's girls academy week.
Oh,
we're gonna start with a 2018 Suspiria.
Against the backdrop of violent political unrest and a perpetually gloomy 1977 Berlin, sheltered Mennonite and ambitious dancer Susie arrives at the prestigious Marcos Dance Academy right after the mysterious disappearance of a troubled student. Before long, yet another ballet girl goes missing. Could this renowned dance academy instead be a den of ancient witches?
I despised this movie the first time I watched it, and I'm not sure what made me revisit it. I definitely did before Trent picked Bones and All, and this is the same director. So this is Luca Guadagnino. This movie is incredible. You couldn't really get any more different than Dario Argento's 77 masterpiece, and I honestly think that this is better. And you really can't compare the two. You know, Guadagnino has said that he loves that movie. It's a major influence on him, and he wanted to take it in a completely different direction. which he did. You know, Argento's is known for these really bright, neon-y colors, beautiful set pieces that are very sharp, has that great Goblin soundtrack. So you get like the cool, like pre-80s, like synthy, rad, mysterious, but sometimes even like techno dancey. And then what Guadagnino does is he just dulls it down. You know, Kat mentioned the backdrop of 77 Germany. It's all these dull colors. It is Thom Yorke from Radiohead doing the soundtrack. It couldn't be any more different than the Goblin soundtrack. And then what Guadagnino does, which I loved about Bones and All, is he just drives home characters. So it's a long movie, but I think that it's appropriately long. You guys are going to fall out of your seats. I think this movie could have been even longer because he develops the characters, which is something if you go back and revisit Argento's, which I did this week, so that is something I watched. But Argento's is so good, but he doesn't really develop the characters. And he sort of saves that whole, the whole coven thing for the very end. So we're not spoiling anything when we talk about the fact that Susie just walks into a coven of witches that are running a dance studio, essentially to groom women and potentially have them become, you know, future vessels for one of the three major mothers, because that's the opening sequence where Chloe Grace Moretz's character is like trying to escape and is like, hey, I think my dance school is a bunch of witches, bro. And then she goes missing. So right off the bat, the suspense is done. What Guadagnino does is now you're focusing on Susie because you're like, Susie, don't you know you're in this like coven of witches and you're just watching this innocent girl from Ohio come into what you know is a very precarious situation. And that's where the suspense lies. I think Dakota Johnson as Susie gives one of the best performances I've seen in all of Dakota Johnson films. She's phenomenal. And then, of course, you have Tilda Swinton. So it does lack in like overall like horror scares. I don't think that Guadagnino is ever going to do a genre flick that's just like overtly scary in the horror genre. But what this one does in character development and heart and some of like the driving political themes, it's still gory as fuck and very, very disturbing to watch. So revisiting this yet again, I think this is brilliant. I'm pissed at myself that I was so dismissive of it at first, and super glad that I can grow as a person and say that this movie's awesome.
Luca Guadagnino did not see Black Swan.
That's amazing. But did he see Climax?
I have a very similar experience with this movie. I hated it the first time, was not ready. To call it a remake of Suspiria is almost, I mean, it takes the most basic plot of Suspiria. A young American girl goes to a prestigious dance academy in Berlin that is run by witches. That's it. That's the only thing. So I was not ready for that. I mean, Suspiria, as much as we all love it, the original, is a very goofy 90-minute horror film, and it's all about the stylization, the one-of-a-kind stylization of Dario Argento at his peak. And you know, that's it, man. That's all, you know. And if you try to get into the story about the three mothers and all this stuff, I mean, it's gobbledygook. It's nonsense. So there's really nothing, you know, there's nothing really there. If you don't have that stylization, it's almost like, what do you do with the movie? Well, if you're these guys, Guadagnino and his writer, who's the same writer as Bones and All and A Bigger Splash and other Guadagnino films, if you're them, you take it and you go the opposite way with the look and the style. You go winter wash tone, bleak tones. There's nothing bright in it at all. And then you just stuff it to the absolute gills with as much thematic undertone as you possibly can until it's just, it's ridiculous. So I just wasn't ready for that. It's very slow, too. It's at 2.5 hours. It's not a quick 2.5 hours. It's very slow. First time I saw this, I was like, you got to be kidding me. There's no amount of bloodshed at the last can make up for this. I hated it. And then same as you, I revisited it just, you know, for the heck of it. And I was like, this is fantastic. I love this movie. So now I've seen it three times. I watched it again. Third time, okay, I still love it. I do, but I can see why it has garnered somewhat of a polarized response from critics, and I love it because there's so much about it that's awesome, and that we'll talk about. But I wouldn't argue with anyone who didn't like it. All the things that people who didn't like it say, I have no argument for. Yes, I agree. There are lots of things that are that you could criticize about this movie. It's insane. It's an insane movie, but I love it.
I think I would have liked this movie a lot more if I hadn't seen the original Suspiria, because when you think Suspiria, as you guys have already said, you think of this like fluorescent, like daydream of a film.
Yes.
Like a beautiful, horrific symphony of color and murder and like supernatural beings in the end. This one, however, very beige tone, as you just said, like very one note, with that really only being like kind of broken up by that red cord kind of costume of the dancers and the blood that we eventually get to. That being said, I do not hate this movie. I thought it was great. I didn't love it. It was just less, I don't know, it was less suspenseful to me as a whole, because you find out literally right away that it's a coven of witches. And you're like, oh, okay. Whereas in the original, you go through the whole film, and then in the end, you're like, as you guys said, you know, oh, it's witches. So you definitely have to separate the two, for sure. And then you can kind of appreciate both of them in their own ways. I liked, however, that this one went that route where right away, you know, they're witches. Tilda's fucking killing the game. She's got everyone. She's got like 17 different roles in this movie. So instead of just following this one girl, this one American girl kind of trying to find her way through this like dance academy, you're following the dance academy first, and then in addition, this American girl who's trying to figure it out. So in its own way, it was very interesting and I liked that, but then it just goes off the rails. Like, you reach a certain point, not here to spoil anything, but you reach this point with this student and you're like, okay. And I didn't really think that had anything to do with the original one. But again, I didn't like hate it for that. It was just very abrupt and not confusing, but I just wasn't expecting that. But I think that's kind of effective in that they were like, hey, this isn't a remake. This is an inspiration of the original film, and then they kind of went their own way with it. And so I think it was very powerful in that instance. It kind of just left me staring at the screen. And it was a long 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I remember I was queuing up. I'm in the middle of moving apartments right now. So I was trying to find like a beautiful moment. I'm like, hey, let me take a seat. Why don't I watch a beautiful film for my podcast? Oh, this one's 2.5 hours long. Whereas the original version is 1.5 hours. Okay, wasn't expecting that, but here we go. It was, I don't want to say a lot, because it really wasn't a lot. It was just very drawn out. But all the characters were very likable. I really liked, what's her name? Dakota
Johnson.
I really liked her character. Her character was very likable. It was just like the story that surrounded her that I wasn't like super into. I might have hated it less without like the Suspiria kind of moniker around it. So I wasn't the biggest fan, but I think it's worth a rewatch for me, especially for the gore and the effects, that contortioned body situation was beautiful. It was disgusting and beautiful to watch. And it was an intense, I feel like that scene went on for like 10 minutes of just a woman writhing in pain. You know, I was a fan, but I think it deserved its own kind of a name, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I railed on with the Wrong Turn remake, because I was like, why does it have to be called Wrong Turn? But, you know, I mean, I think that when you're going into a film, it's a decision by the filmmakers to call it, you know, a remake or a reimagining or whatever. I still stand by that. I think that's super debatable. Like, you can go make your own film if it veers off enough.
Well, it was definitely like the same plot. Like, absolutely, I agree. It was like this. It was inspired by, is what they called it. So I definitely agree with that. Like, they took parts of the original and kind of made it their own. But I feel like they could have just named it something else instead of Suspiria without like anything else.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this is more climax than the original Suspiria. I mean, this is basically like kind of like climax with witches and a little black swan, like you mentioned, Trent. That being said, like Kat, you mentioned the scene with Olga and the whole, you know, as Dakota Johnson is doing a dance, there's this other dancer that's trying to leave the academy, and every move that Johnson does, she, in like a witchy way, is not of her own free will doing the same moves, but in such gruesome, violent ways. That's a classic scene like that. I think this movie, because you said it, Trent, it is so polarizing. You're not going to find someone that's like, yeah, it was okay. Yeah, I mean, you're going to find some people that are like, no, I totally dig it. You got to stick through it. Or you're going to find people that are like, yeah, screw that movie. But that is a classic scene. Like, that should go down when you're watching highlight reels and, you know, these like the 100 greatest, like whatever scenes. Like, that is an unbelievable scene. It's so uncomfortable. It's so well done with the practical effects. It's legendary.
Yeah, incredible scene. Yeah, that was the first time I watched the movie. I was like, wow, okay, I'm in. And then, you know, it just is so, it's so drawn. It's so slow. Not, and I don't even mean that in a bad way. It just is what it's slow. I loved the slowness of it. Now I loved every frame. Tilda Swinton, you mentioned Cash. She plays three different roles in this.
No, and, I said 17.
Yeah. Well, yeah, almost.
You're close.
She, just like in Only Lovers Left Alive, she is incredible. I believe she is a witch. Oh, I love her name. I love hearing people say Madame Blanc. It's scary. Madame Blanc? Madame Blanc is here? Oh my God, is Madame Blanc coming to the audition? Madame Blanc, Susie's all excited. Madame Blanc saw me. And she just is a witch. She inhabits that role just as much as she did the vampire in Only Lovers Left Alive. And speaking of that movie, I think it's a little funny that some of us called Only Lovers Left Alive pretentious art house hipster, and now we're watching this is way more pretentious, way more.
Come at me, bro.
This is a thousand times more pretentious than Only Lovers Left Alive. A thousand.
No, it's not there. This is not full of 7,000 insider hipster references that are very specific.
Maybe it's
references.
Not as hipster. Okay. If you think, if Shakespeare is a hipster reference, I don't know. But I mean, tell me about the whole World War II Holocaust. Why are we talking about the Holocaust in this movie? What's that all about?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Or was that just you're throwing that question out into the air?
So it's based in 1977 in Germany, which is the year that the original movie came out. And if actually you could do a lot of Wikipedia-ing about this, the events around this movie, because in 1977 was an era in Germany called the German Autumn. And there's all kinds of stuff going on. And a lot of it is hinted at in this movie. There is a lot of civil unrest. There's rebels and there's bombings, there's hostages, there's you name it, everything under the sun they sort of allude to in this movie. And I guess having listened to, you know, I don't know that I would pick it up so much, but having listened to a couple interviews with Guadagnino, they're trying to sort of allude to the idea of the new generation indicting the older generation for wanting to, I don't know, not feeling guilty enough about the Holocaust, not taking account for their roles in World War II, trying to whitewash it. And that somehow relates to Susie being Mother Suspirioso or whatever the hell. And she what?
I don't think all the points get driven home. And I think that Swinton's amazing, even as the character Klemperer, whatever his name is. I don't think that gets driven home enough. I don't think everything is like necessarily nailed. That's why I say like it potentially could have been even longer or shorter if you just cut out some of those some of like the really overt political stuff where he's obviously trying to tie it into, like you said, guilt. I mean, there's a line at the end where Dakota Johnson says, you know, we need guilt, but not yours.
Right.
So there that I think it was supposed to sort of tie in and kind of personalize some of like the really overarching political themes that he's trying to bring into this. And I also think that there was like a sort of oppression theme that he was bringing in here and sort of, you know, he doesn't really ever say like who was right and who was wrong in any of the situations, even with the witches per se. So I think he was also talking about how it's easy to sort of get swept up in a situation where you kind of feel both comfortable and competitive, and that that can sort of like have you lose your way. But I'm not saying that he nailed everything. I definitely want to come in the other room and punch you right in the face for trying to say it's even remotely as fucking hipster and friggin' snooty.
Okay, I mean, we have to define.
We were going to fight. You need to get your chest cold out of here before we're done recording and out that door, because I'm coming at you.
We have to define hipster. I was just saying that this is, to me, much more pretentious than that movie. That's all I'm saying.
Pretentious, okay.
Pretentious, yeah.
So there's the three, I couldn't pronounce them, Suspirium, right? And then...
Suspiriorum.
Suspiriorum. And then some other ones.
Yeah, there's the three, the three mothers, sure.
three mothers. That's your easy out.
If we could spoil a little bit, there's this woman who's like a grotesque, boiled, kind of puffed out being who says she's the Suspirium mother, and is trying to like sacrifice people for her. Why, if she's not the real Suspirium mother, why is she like that? Is she just still involved in like the witchy ways, or is she a different kind of mother that we don't know about, or like what? Because that was kind of confusing for me, where it was like, she's like, I'm this person, and this person's like, psych, nope, it's me. But then she was still there and like living somehow in this disgusting kind of sack of existence.
Yeah, they don't get like super over explainy with it. To me, that's like the whole witchcraft thing. I think the reason, like at the beginning, Patricia, Chloe Grace Moretz's character, I think they're grooming, they're looking for people that can accept sort of this power. So remember like when Dakota Johnson first gets there, Tilda Swinton kind of like almost like right before the Olga scene that we talked about, like the really graphic scene, she kind of touches her feet and like almost like gives her some like power. That's kind of like what the scene is hinting at. So I think they're like grooming women, young women in the dance academy that they feel are fit to be willing vessels. And that's how some of these witches, regardless of whether or not you're a mother, you can perform these rituals and put yourself into a vessel and just continue living. So I think Mother Marcos...
She was willing to be that, and so that's what gave her that power, but then people were like, nah, it's actually me, kind of a situation.
I think Marcos was just playing a game. I think Marcos was just pretending to be one of the three mothers and getting this coven to continuously run through the ritual to keep her alive basically forever.
Yes.
Because Guadagnino has talked about how he had sequels planned, and one of them was like hundreds of years, like 400 years before this, showing like Marcos as a witch and sort of like her journey. So I think the whole thing, well, I think it was twofold. And again, it's maybe where the movie's getting pretentious, but I think it was also like one of the themes is like women oppressing women as well, and sort of like using each other in roles of power. And so I think a big thing of the movie is deception, obviously. So I think Marcos was just like basically like the queen of deception. She had been deceiving these people. Blanc, however, was kind of onto it. And yeah, Blanc was sort of making a power play to be like, you know what, bitch, like it's time for you to die. I would like to get voted as like the new, not even like one of the three mothers. I think that's where it gets confusing, is you're assuming that they're all vying for this sort of like one of the three mothers. But I think what they're really vying for is just have control over this coven / dance studio, and to be the one that as the ritual happens, they're the one that receives the new vessel. So I think Blanc was doing a power play against Marcos. Marcos was like, no, I'm one of the original mothers, so I'm going to kill everybody that goes against me. And then the huge twist and reveal at the ending is like, none of y'all are legit. Here I am. Everyone's dead.
Yeah, I think there was definitely one of the many sort of subtextual themes in this, like you alluded to, is the sort of the power dynamics among women. And I've heard people call this a queer horror movie because there are some, certainly some sexual tension, and there are some laughs in this, we should mention. I loved when Susie climbs into bed with Sarah, who's played by Mia Goth, and she says, I've only ever slept with my sister. And there are a few moments like that. And according to Guadagnino, they had a few more explicit sex scenes or explicitly sexual scenes among some of the members of the Academy that they cut out because they felt like they had already established enough sexual tension and enough sort of like queer undertones that they were satisfied with it. And they didn't want to make it more obvious than that. One of my favorite parts was when they ask Sarah, where are you from? They're all very worldly Europeans, you know, at the school. Where are you from? And she says, Ohio. It was good. Good laugh moment. You know, if you get too caught up in the oppressive atmosphere, I think you can miss. There's a lot of very funny stuff in this. I thought it was really insane how long the movie went on after the climax. You have finally, you know, 2 hours in, you get this insane, absolutely bonkers. I can't even imagine filming that whole climax scene. It's tremendous. One of the greatest occult ritual scenes ever put on film by anyone. I was just blown away. And you think, oh my, yeah, that's it. Wow, what a movie. And then no, there's a lot more. There's a whole epilogue. I loved when it then cuts to the witches. It goes right back to reality, and it just cuts to them like cleaning up the blood, and they're like, wait, yes. How can it not be over? And then, oh no, there's an epilogue. Now we're back to the guy played by Tilda Swinton and the Holocaust stuff. You're like, my God. And I'm not complaining. I just thought it was so crazy to do all that, lead you up to that, and then be like, nah, there's a ways more after that, actually.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've focused, well, and first and foremost, we're talking about an absolutely crazy bonkers movie that Mia Goth is in, and she is not the crazy bonkers one. So
yeah, no,
that's
right.
How
yeah,
fucking
yeah.
bonkers this movie is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things that unfortunately the length and how many characters he is trying to develop, that's where it does miss the mark a little bit, because this movie, despite how gory and oppressive and all the things we're talking about to describe, it's also really emotional. But I think it's, you have to stick with it and stay very, very close to it. It's actually a really emotional and even compassionate movie. Now, it could make your definition of compassion fucked up, but it is actually an incredibly emotional movie. I think where the Klemperer, the Tilda Swinton playing the man, I think he's a psychologist, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, you know, that whole storyline doesn't totally nail it. It does let you swoop in our original Susie for a cameo.
I forgot all about that.
Yeah, love that.
That is a really emotional, the epilogue and everything with him. I thought that was really emotional. I even thought like the compassion in that insane ending where Mother Suspiriorum is like, what do you wish for? And they're like, death. And she just very compassionately is like, you will die now. She doesn't explode them like some other folks. But I think there's a lot of emotion in this movie that gets a little bit maybe missed because you are moving from some slow, supposed to be, I think, like mystery and tension sequences to some very overtly uncomfortable, be it gory or graphic or however, scenes to some like, okay, now I got to listen to some political stuff on the radio and then deal with the coven in the kitchen and what are the political and dynamics happening here within the coven leaders. But I did really, upon all these subsequent watches, like felt like there's, and Guadagnino does this in Bones and All as well, which is the only film of his that I have really any experience with. You know, he really does find a way to like drive some heart into some kind of fucked up characters and situations.
I love the idea of dance as Witch's Spell, Dance as Possession. I thought that was really cool. It makes a lot of sense that the dance itself becomes a form of spell and a form of group possession. And the dance scenes are incredible. Johnson apparently trained for like 2 years to do the physical parts of this movie. It's really, you know, depending on what strain you're on, you know, I would recommend just get yourself some good weed, get very stoned. You might even want to attack this, you know, episodically. You know, watch 45 minutes, take a breather, think about it. You know, treat it as a four-part a mini series, because there is so much great stuff to offer. And, you know, when I criticize it, there are just some things that I can't avoid it. But I loved all of the dance scenes I thought were like transfixing, what were they? They were
pretentious.
They were really good. No, the dance was, yes, now that you mention it, yes. I don't think I would be the first person or last person to call some of the dance stuff a bit pretentious. Well, and I liked how they act like the dancing is physically, it's very dangerous. Like they're not going to let Susie do,
hold on, you're not ready.
Like, somebody's going to die if you do this dance before you're ready. And I think obviously that was, you know, kind of about the spell aspect of it, but mm-hmm. all that stuff was great. I mean, it's an amazing thing to watch.
Speaking of how you should attack this, I'm going to now use our movie break to attack Trent.
Wait, now, yeah. Speaking of attack this, Dario Argento has panned this movie a few different times. Not a fan, but you know, that's understandable. And this
Was he not a producer? Was he not involved in any way?
He gave them the right to do whatever they wanted, and he said nobody ever called him one time. After that,
that's a fucking bummer to be.
Yeah, honest. I mean, I don't care what Dario Argento thought. I just think it's interesting. Okay. He didn't like it. I'm not surprised. This was you mentioned, Kevin. I didn't know that they had sequel ideas, but this was a modest $20 million budget. I think for what they produced, only made $7 million. This was a big bomb at the box office.
Yeah, I mean, Argento stopped making good movies not long after Suspiria, so I can't imagine
opera was 10 years later, bro.
Okay, that's fair, but anyway, yeah, this sucked. I think we talked about In Bones and All, Guadagnino is yet to really find the box office success that I think
right.
he did. Yeah. He definitely found critical success, and he hasn't really made like a completely over genre film yet. So,
right.
I think he's always dancing between genres, but they're always, you know, very well made films. So I'm hoping he has that that commercial hit to go along with his critical darling status.
You guys ever remember that show, The Terror, on AMC?
Yeah,
they just greenlit a third season. Did you ever see the first season, Infamy, about the boat, the explorers?
Yeah,
that was developed and written by the writer of this. I can't pronounce his last name, David, whoever wrote Suspiria.
Yeah, Kajianik or something. Yeah.
He developed and wrote The Terror, which I thought was awesome. That's like one of the only episodic television shows that I could tell you about. That is really good. You haven't seen The Terror? It's on Shudder right now, also on Prime. And this is on Prime right now, or VOD.
There's an Amazon original, which another box office twist on this is this was an Amazon original movie.
True.
And I think you could pretty much get it on Prime like right away.
Yeah, good point.
I think
good
even point. Before, like this was before COVID, this is before they were really testing like what happens if we put movies out streaming and everything. So,
yeah.
But yeah, this lives on Prime. Like, you could pretty much watch it now. If you pay for Prime, you can even watch this with ads. All right, I can't remember what Trent used as a descriptor for this week, but for my next pick, full disclosure, if you haven't seen The Black Coat's Daughter, we are going to spoil the shit out of this movie. Otherwise, this conversation will be approximately 5 minutes. So this one does have an even bigger twist than Suspiria. You have to watch the film. So if you haven't seen it, I would highly recommend stopping this now. Go watch The Black Coat's Daughter. Come back and check it out. But we will be spoiling it. And with that, my second pick this week is Osgood Perkins' 2015 film, The Black Coat's Daughter.
Two Catholic schoolgirls, Kat and Rose, get left behind at their boarding school over winter break as the other girls leave, where it's rumored that the nuns are Satanists. Meanwhile, a disturbed escaped mental patient, Joan, is picked up by a middle-aged couple who drive her on a determined trip to the same school, where the girls must face the supernatural and demonic possession.
I guess now that I think about it, this could be Kevin's pretentious hipster witch week.
Yes, it is.
You could just see the screen right now. Trent's face just lit up, like, in just such affirmation.
So this is one. I liked both movies. I don't mind pretension.
Hey,
it's fine.
Come on, we're just playing. This wasn't a widely released film, but if you are into the horror genre enough, like, this one would keep popping up. And it was sort of like early A24, like before A24 just kind of exploded.
Yeah.
But this is one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years, hands down. Another one of those films that I've talked about where, like, this is a comfort watch if I need something to throw on. And one of my favorite things about this is an incredibly twisty film with, in my opinion, super high rewatchability, because it's a very honest, twisty film and mostly plays by the rules, and you can always kind of pick something up upon a rewatch. It also, like Suspiria, is very slow, does not have sort of like mid-sequence payoffs like Suspiria does, so you don't get the Olga dance scene or anything like that in The Black Coat's Daughter. It's just solely dependent upon putting you in a very familiar setting as a horror fan. So I'm at a Catholic girls' school. Ooh, there's a vacation coming up. It's winter. It is dreary, and you've got some teenage girls. Like, you think you're going into a very cliche horror setting, and like I said, you're very dependent upon the performances of our main characters here. And fortunately for us, again, in my opinion, they kill it. And none of this heads the way that you think it's going to. Like, you think it's set up so that it could be like a slasher. It could be, you know, sort of a coming of age. Kat already sort of alluded to it. It could be The Conjuring. It could be a possession film and things like that. It's really kind of none of the above, really, at the end of the movie by the time you get there. Unlike Suspiria, which I thought was relatively linear in terms of like storyline, this one does confuse you a little bit on first watch, because you're following Kat and Rose at the school. You do jump to a timeline with another character, Joan, and that gets a little bit confusing when you're trying to kind of figure out exactly where you are in the story. But again, even all of that aside, the performances sort of get you through it, even if you have to kind of like scratch your head by the end of it. And then you have the actors playing the roles. You have Kieran Shipka as Kat. You have Lucy Boynton as Rose. And then Emma Roberts is playing Joan. Those are our three kind of main players here. And then James Remar and Lauren Holly play a pair of parents that come into the Joan storyline. Really understated performances by both, especially Lauren Holly. I mean, Jesus, I grew up with her on Dumb and Dumber, so this is not the Lauren Holly that I remember. And Remar is very understated, but good. Like Suspiria, I thought this one also had a lot of heart and is like really kind of at the end of the day, very emotional and honestly kind of depressing. But for me, again, like Suspiria, not necessarily scary, but it is, I think, scarier than Suspiria. And like I said, I could go on forever. I love this movie.
So I think recently I talked about the film The Holdovers, which I think was a critically acclaimed. It won awards, beautiful. So I went into this thinking, great, it's like a lady version of The Holdovers. Psych. I got to say, though, it was fun. You know, fun in that it kept me curious for a little bit until it made me be like, oh no. I'm not personally a huge fan of Kiernan Shipka, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, because I don't ever really believe her acting, because it's very much like a, I'm mad and this is why I'm mad, and I'm Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and oh, I'm so upset about this, and Mad Men, and blah, blah, blah. So it's always like a very, she's not good. But, oh my stars, this is great. This is probably my new favorite role of hers, to be honest. Maybe it was the demonic possession that just came naturally to her. I'm not really sure, but she killed it. I was very into it. Everyone else, also great. I really liked the actors in this one. Emma Roberts, again, also like always an kind of a person for me. Usually just seeing her in like teen comedies or like FX, whatevers. But I thought she was great. I was flabbergasted because I wasn't really expecting the turn of events that happened, especially so quickly. So definitely the timeline's very weird, and it took me a second to kind of understand what was going on. I didn't want to spoil them, but I guess we're kind of just spoiling everything. It was very gruesome. It was a gruesome kind of a situation, and it was interesting. It was enjoyable, but also it kind of left you trying to kind of figure out what was going on between these timelines. So you didn't realize were there until you realized they were there.
Yeah.
Did I love the ending? Not particularly, but then it kind of got you thinking. It was like, so we're kind of left with this Joan character who's been brought to this her old Catholic school, and you find out that she realizes that she's just like fully alone. She's got nothing. She doesn't have humans. She doesn't have human friends. She doesn't have a boiler. She doesn't have any satanic friends. She's got nothing. And so she's just kind of left by herself. And then she's weeping in this like beautiful, like it's upstate New York, but it could be a New England landscape just behind her. And it was a beautiful moment. It was sad also, but also beautiful. It was a very weird. I think it's worth a rewatch for sure, for maybe 2 to 3 times. Because I think overall it's a beautiful and very odd and frightening film, but it's also like a weird, like internal tale, which you try to figure out along the way. I thought it was fucking great. I thought I love this one.
Yeah, I love this one too. And I went on a journey. This was Perkins' first directorial effort, even though it was released second, wasn't released until Netflix had I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House.
Yep.
I was so confused. I mean, a little confusing. I was very, very confused. And one of the reasons is because I think the twist that we'll reveal worked too well for me. So I had to watch it once. Then I watched it again, or then I looked it up. And then I was like, oh, duh. So I had to like read the whole synopsis. Then I watched it knowing everything fully. And I was like, wow. Incredible. Great, great movie. My only question about this movie is if you took out the timeline, if you took out the twist, which is kind of an unfair twist, I think.
A little bit.
It's a little unfair. If you took out the twist, what is it? I kind of feel like it is the twist. Like I kind of feel like that's the thing that it is, and if you didn't have that, I'm not sure what the movie would be, and I'm not complaining because I think it's a great movie, but that was kind of my main question is, okay, you got me. Well, you didn't get me. We'll talk about it. I loved it. It was great. This is a great watch. And I had never seen it. Thank you, Kevin.
I don't think you need the twist in order to drive home what the movie's really about. And like I said, like it sets itself up so it could be a number of different things. But at the end of the day, it's really about, it kind of is like a coming of age film in a really fucked up way, but it's about loss. Kat and Rose are left at this school over a break as the only two students left behind. But the film starts with Kat sort of having like this premonition about her parents. And her parents are supposed to show up at the school and pick her up and take her away over the break. Rose is staying behind for a completely different reason. Rose thinks that she's pregnant, so she's lied to her parents so that she can stay behind and kind of deal with that situation without having to tell her parents. She got the boyfriend to deal with and all that. So you, right off the bat, there's all this like really weird stuff with like, okay, they're just going to let this girl stay here. Even though her parents were supposed to be here and they're not. And Kat just like, she knows like something is up with my folks. Like they should be here. And that's where Shipka's performance gets really good. So it's at the end of the day, it's about like loss and how you deal with that. And that scene that you talk about, Trent, with the priest, she just wants someone there to watch her piano and her singing performance.
Oh, I don't think so. Let me jump in.
Okay.
She wants to know if the priest is going to be there to interfere with her. Oh, she's already under the spell at that point. And she asks him how long it will take him to get back, because she knows that he's going to get called when she starts doing her shit. And she's wondering how much time she has before he gets back. That's
all right,
why.
That's fair.
That's why she's asking that.
All right. That's
also,
fair.
Could the priest be touching her?
No.
Have we thought
I think
about
they're
that?
Alluding to that, but that's kind of like a gimme at that point to just like.
Okay. I picked up on a little bit of that.
Oh, interesting. You thought maybe there was the priest.
There was a moment. I'm trying to remember which part it was, but there was like definitely a moment where he was like, there was like a flashback situation that he was kind of seemed like that was happening. So
interesting.
No, that was at the very beginning.
She says, "Daddy, you came early."
I think that's the demon.
I did too.
Or it could just be part of her premonition of her parents have died in a car crash, and she somehow knows that already.
But he came. The demon is who came and showed her.
Yes.
And she says, "Daddy, you came early," and then he takes her on the walk, and he shows her the parents' car.
Yeah. So I think that even without the twist, like, again, to go back to harp on my point about loss, like, she loses her parents. Obviously, Rose loses her life, and then that's when the timeline gets in. You meet James Remar and Lauren Hawley, who you discover are Rose's parents, and that now it's like, what, 7 years in the future or something, and
they're just
going back to the school where their daughter died. There's loss there, and then the ending that Kat's talking about, where you realize that Joan is actually Kat, and she's escaped from a mental institution where she was put after doing all the fucked up stuff that she did over that winter break. And she's just trying to get back there because that's where the demon is. And then she realizes she's alone and she's lost her parents. She's lost the demon now that she was holding on to. Because there's the last scene, I think it's the last scene with Kieran and Shipka, is where she is like being institutionalized or something. And she says, like, don't go to the demon.
To the demon, yeah.
Like, don't go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's so innocent, like so creepy.
Because that's that moment where she's going to be alone after that. So then after that, she has no one. She doesn't have her parents. They're dead. She doesn't have the demon. He's gone. She doesn't have anyone else because she's murdered them.
I love the possession stuff, and I love the shadow of the demon with the horns. It almost looks like the shadow of a weird rabbit more than a... But that
Donnie
makes it,
Darko.
That makes yeah, it's like yeah. a Donnie Darko shadow. Yeah. But that makes it creepier. I loved that. I thought this movie was incredibly subtle, and at times I thought it was almost too subtle. I think that he's got such a Osgood Perkins has got such a light touch and such a subtle touch with some of the stuff that I'm like straining to pick it up. I feel like maybe a little too. I mean, there were like five severed heads in this. I was trying to tell what they were. Like, oh, wait a minute. It took me two watches to realize they were severed heads. Now that's too subtle. If you got severed heads and I don't know what they are, I have to rewind it. What the hell was that? I got to look up Wikipedia. Oh, it was a severed head.
Stop being so pretentious with your severed heads.
Yeah, I shouldn't have to work that hard to know what a severed head is, you know?
Well, and that's why I think a few weeks ago I had watched I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. That is even slower, even more subtle, and requires like even more attention, potentially like going, like doing some research and going back and to rewatch. Like he slows it down even further than The Black Coat's Daughter and makes it even more sort of like hard to like pull apart. Also a good movie, but yeah, again, even slower. So this is impressive for a first effort.
Yeah.
From Perkins, who I think we've talked about. I mean, Perkins is the son of Anthony Perkins. His brother Elvis Perkins did the music for this. So you've got like a real connection in the world there.
Yeah. And yeah, I didn't realize that Osgood played young. He was in Psycho 2. He played young Norman Bates in Psycho 2. I didn't realize that. But the confusion of the story and the subtlety did something that I do really like in movies and that I have to remind myself sometimes when I'm watching a movie. Sometimes I'm so anxious and I'm so eager to understand every single thing that's being shown to me. Sometimes I have to remind myself that the reason that, you know, the movie, you're watching the movie because the movie is going to show you. And I get very caught up sometimes early in a movie going like, well, who is that? Well, who is that? Well, what does that mean? Well, what's the relation to this? And I'm all like, well, what the hell? And I have to sometimes remind myself, just slow down, just watch the movie. Not every movie is going to tell you what every single thing is. Sometimes you just have to actually watch the whole 90 minutes to understand what all the things were. So just relax. Let the filmmaker show you what he's trying to show you. He's showing you everything he wants you to see, or she. And so just do that. Just sit back. Don't worry about knowing what every single thing means, but you'll get it in the end.
I think my favorite performance in the movie from an understated place is James Remar. So he plays Rose's dad. So, I mean, ultimately, Kiernan Shipka just kills, what, two nuns and Rose? Mm-hmm. Brings their heads down to the boiler and is like praying to the demon there. And so then when you fast forward, you get to the Joan timeline. Like I said, it's Kat grown up and having escaped from the institution, and she wants to get back there. And lo and behold, Rose's parents just happened to be making their annual trip back to see where their daughter died. And Remar is obviously a very broken dad that lost his kid. His performance is so uncomfortable. Yeah. Like how almost like creepy and nice and sad. And it's like one of those performances where I got more of like a touchy vibe off of him in some of the scenes with Emma Roberts as Joan. It also made me think like that sometimes those types of performances or the way that people deal with loss and grief, they come off to us sometimes as embarrassing because you don't know how to act. Like we have not built a very healthy culture of like how to process or let people process their own grief and loss. And when they do sort of like, I mean, at the end of the day, he's just a super nice guy that lost his daughter and would do anything for this random girl he picked up on the side of the road, but all of us are like, ooh, he's weird and embarrassing. And oh, like it's so fucking, that's one of like the really like most poignant parts of the film. And like, and Lauren Hawley is the mom. It's just like pissed at him the whole time. And, you know, clearly there are a couple that have not come to terms with this horribly tragic thing that happened.
100%. I thought he was going to victimize her.
Yeah,
for a long time. I mean, it took until, you know, it's kind of, I'm waiting for what his game is when he comes into her hotel room. She's gotten out of the shower. I mean, I'm just waiting for this guy. Like, I thought he was going to be some kind of bad guy. I'm just waiting for him to do something because that's the vibe that it's giving you. I want to ask you guys, though. Did you guys, when the movie ended, did you understand that Joan was Kat? The first time you watched it?
I mean, I've watched this a lot. I don't think I did the first time I watched it, Trent. I think I was actually in the same boat you ended up in. I just happened to catch an earlier trip down the river. I think I like watched it again. That is also very subtle. They really do show you quick flashbacks that kind of help you piece together. Because like Joan's got like bullet wounds, and it's not till the very end where you see that the cop shoots Kat in the boiler room.
Yep, and they give you a flash of that early on. Did you, Kat, when you did you understand that Joan was Kat when the movie ended?
It took some research.
I knew it.
Obviously, I didn't, Trent. I'm obviously the one out of all of us that's not going to know what's going on.
I didn't eat. No, this is the thing. This is why I want to ask you guys, because I had the strangest.
I had no idea.
Okay, me neither. I had the strangest experience, but it's so weird. It's ironic because the first time I watched this movie, I thought right away the gag worked too well for me, because I thought right away, I just thought that Kat and Joan were the same person. And I was so confused as to how could Kat be at the school and hitchhiking at the same time? I was like, well, I know she was just at the school And now she's like at a hotel and she's hitchhiking with this couple and it keeps, how could she be doing? And then I was like, oh, well, I guess it's a different timeline. So I guess that's a different time, but when is, and then they show, you find out that the parents are the parents of Rose. I'm going, what in it? Sam Hill. And then what happened is even funnier. I looked it up real quick after I watched it and I just saw, I knew I was going to watch it again because I was so confused. And I just read enough to see that the three different names, oh, it's divided up in three parts, Kat, Rose, and Joan. So I'm like, oh, that's not, okay, so Kat and Joan are two totally different people. Okay, dumb, I'm a dummy. Okay, I just think all blonde women look alike. All right, so now I get, but I didn't read any more than that. So then I watched it again and I was like, ah, oh, they're all different people. That's cool. And then I was like, wow, that's weird though. What did Joan have to do with it? They're all different people. I don't really get that. So then I had to look it up again. I'd be like, I was right the first time, but I wasn't supposed to know that. What the hell is this movie? Come on.
It gave some inklings. It did give some inklings, I will say. I felt
it's,
some inklings.
It's really, really good if you go back and you, like, once you
it's
fully
all there.
Know.
It's
and
all
you
there.
Watch, especially Shipka and Roberts do a really good job of, like, mimicking each other and having some of those same, like, sort of, like, vacant and almost like kind of like innocent and spacey responses. But so it wasn't too good for me trying. What really got me the first time that stopped me from maybe realizing that is what you said before about being so caught up in James Remar and his intentions with this young girl that he just picked up hitchhiking, that when she all of a sudden just busts out of the backseat and cuts their fucking heads off, that I was so caught off guard when Emma Roberts did that, like every other little mystery that I was trying to solve erased itself from my mind. And I was just like, holy shit, didn't see that coming. And then I just like completely, you know, missed everything probably after that.
Because by that point, you know that she's murdered someone else to steal their identity. And you're like, well, they deserved it. You know, you're like, well, we don't know the backstory. Like, maybe she did it because that person like did something to her. But then out of nowhere, she's like, and then you're like, nope, we're done now with this person. So that's when it kind of takes that turn of being like, she's the villain now. She is the absolute antagonist.
Yeah. Yeah.
The one thing that I will say that I did find a little bit questionable is that the parents of the girl who you beheaded don't recognize you at all, regardless of much time has gone
by. You'd think they would even know that she escaped, but I mean, come on now. That is a little much. And also,
that's the only thing, but you never
know. I would add, I think it's kind of a dirty trick to cast two entirely different actresses and then be like,
it's ridiculous.
Oh, it's the same person. Like, oh, okay. Well, I thought that at the beginning, but that's so ridiculous. How could that be the case? And then I thought I was stupid, but I wasn't, but I am. But this, what?
You have a solid right to be mad at this movie.
But it's great. I love it, but it is ridiculous. I mean, it's kind of a little bit of dirty pool, I think.
Well, I highly recommend this one for like an annual winter watch.
And I love the Elvis Perkins score. I was convinced that I was looking for the original traditional folk song called Black Coat's Daughter that is at the beginning of the movie. I thought for sure that was a real.
This makes me even more excited for Long Legs.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Next week.
Woo.
Kat, you're in the hot seat. What have you got for us?
It's Jack Nicholson week. Woo! We've already talked about The Shining, so not The Shining, but The Terror from 1963, which is available on Prime and also Tubi.
All right.
And also 1993's The Wolf.
Okay. Woo. Nice. Michelle Pfeiffer?
Yep. It is a rental.
Nice. Okay.
It's a $3 rental, so it's going to be fine for everyone.
Okay. The Terror.
Yeah.
Not familiar.
He's a young man. Yeah. He's very small.
Okay.